P2RIW here. Starting, sorry, we're starting a little bit late today. For those who managed to hang in there, this is the beginning of the TechNet. K2KEY Mill and K2RIW Nick. Try to, with the help of their friends, answer people's questions. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to give us your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in would sound like WS2N, all, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
W2EWKES.
We got Eugene. Anyone else?
This is N2YJC. Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. And yes, I have a quick question.
Mr. YJC, your name is?
Name is Lou, Dick. Lima Oscar Uniform.
We got you, Lou. All right, we've got Eugene and Lou. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
N2GOT Howard, no.
WA2RY Joe. Question.
Okay, Joe.
2TGW. Last question.
KNB Rich, no.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
And WS2N, what's the space report?
And his name is Paul. So, after Howard, we got Joe, Les, and Rich. Joe, please give me your call letters again.
Whiskey Alpha 2, radio with Yankee Yankee.
Very fine, Joe. And Les, we got him. Les, I think, Les, did you give us a no or a yes? I think you gave us a no. Is that true, Les?
No, I gave you a yes.
No, you gave me a yes. Okay, yes, we have no bananas. Joe, did you give me a yes or a no?
Question, yes.
Okay. From K2MIT also.
K2MIT, I think, is a yes. What is your name, sir?
Jeffrey, Dick.
Oh, we got more than enough to get started. Eugene, go right ahead with your first question. W2EWK, K2RIW in the group.
Yes, W2EWK, right back to you. Dick, when you have a dipole, you know, stretch on the tower, now, when the dipole radiates from you know, the dipole, where does it radiate? You understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to figure out where is the best place for it to radiate. Would you need like a RF meter to find out where she's radiating from, or like a heat gun to see where she's coming from? Back to you there, Dick.
Okay. If you were trying to test for radio frequency biohazard, you wanted to know how much RF energy is hitting your body, you would pick up a product made by the NARDA company called Raham, among other companies, make these things called radiation hazard meter. It reads out in units of milliwatts of power per square centimeter of your body. And you, if you want to, can convert that in watts per meter, watts per square foot, but the most frequently used unit is watts per square centimeter. You could, if you wanted to, pick up one of those meters, and you could make a homebrew version of it. Wouldn't be very difficult at a fixed frequency. What makes the ones that you buy expensive is the fact that they're very broadband. They go over multiple octaves. Some of them, the individual probes work over multiple decades of frequency, but they're very broadband, and they're kind of exact in their calibration, which is traceable to the Bureau of Standards. But you or I could build a field strength meter, something that's got a small little whip antenna on it. With a little bit of difficulty, you could calibrate it. You could then hold this instrument with its meter and a diode rectifier inside near the center of your dipole, 1 foot away from it, so to speak, and walk along the dipole and actually look at how much power comes from various portions. You could do that experiment. you'd have to be a little bit careful in how you do it, because your sensor, if it's real close to the antenna, will pick up direct capacitive effects or direct inductive coupling effects. So you got to back off a certain number of feet. But what you'll find out, most people believe that the signal strength is strongest near the center of the dipole where the current is the highest, and the radiated signal is weaker near the tips of the dipole. Well, I think most of the guys that build sensing meters like that have a meter that senses magnetic field a little bit easier than it senses electrostatic field, E field. And if they had a meter that also measured E field, they'd measure quite a bit of signal strength out at the tips of the dipole with the voltages higher. But the conventional thinking is that more signal is radiated by the center where the current is high than the tip. Part of the proof of that is that if you set up a dipole such that the center portion of it is horizontal and the two tips droop down to become vertical, you know, the last 20% of the dipole to the right and to the left droops down, when you look at that dipole broadside, the direction where most of the radiation takes place, you would find purely horizontal signal and no vertical signal at all. So there's multiple pieces of evidence that the majority of the radiation seems to take place from the center of the dipole where the current is the highest. That's what most of the experimental evidence says, and a foolish person would say, gee, the tips are not doing anything, I can chop them off. Well, you do that and it's not resonant anymore. So they do serve a function out there. They do some of the radiation, and they make sure the whole thing radiates, whole thing resonates. Maybe that helps a little bit. There's a lot of different ways you could answer this question, Eugene. W2EWK, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Okay, thank you, Dick. You answered my question. W2EWK, clear.
All right, it sounds like we got one customer happy so far. Lou, N2YJC, what would you like to ask us tonight?
Hey, Dick, good evening. Can you do me a favor and stick me down at the end of the list? I got an important phone call I got to continue with, N2YJC. Thank you.
Okay, we'll come back to Lou. Howard, I think, N2GOT, I think you gave me a no, but I'm going to give you another chance just in case something occurred to you. Howard, you got it.
Hey, good evening, Dick. And the net. No, I don't have any questions. Just enjoying the net, listening here. If I think of something, I'll go ahead and ask my compadre Mel or you. Back to you, NTGOT.
Very fine. Joe, you're next. WA2 Radio Yankee Yankee, K2RIW.
Yeah, put me at the end of the list also because I'm not in a position to talk very easy on the radio at the moment. I'll be back. Closer to my node in about 5 or 10 minutes. That'll probably be okay.
Okay. So we're going to put Joe at the end of the list and Lou at the end of the list. So we're coming to the end of the list pretty fast. Hey, Les, you got lots of time. K2TGW, what would you like to talk about? K2RIW in the second half.
Good evening, Dick. Was experimenting with antennas for a change, something I can never do before. And I had a question. I have a hamstick. Really started as a 17-meter hamstick with a big, long extension. I found that if I had changed the extension to 6 inches, it would work. It would resonate great on 10 meters. And I have it up on one of the side of one of the eaves. So today was a beautiful day, and I figured I would try to get it up higher. So I put it on one of the masts, and it totally detuned it. But I figured, okay, it's on a metal mast, maybe it's... Somehow it's using the mass as a counterpoise, so that wasn't going to work. So then I put it up on a piece of PVC tubing, or piping, I guess, which was 10 feet long. And I found that detuned it. When I put it back where it originally was, it was fine. Now, I do have a counterpoise on it, and where it is now, it's about, 15 feet off the ground. It's perfectly fine. Now, why, when I raise it, do I detune it so much? Or am I just making a mistake in what I'm looking at? Dick?
Yeah, what I want you to play back for me, Les, is that the hamstick, I think if I understand you correctly, was an 11-meter antenna to start off with. I'm not quite sure which band you intend to use it on. Does it have radials sitting at the bottom? Many of these vertically polarized antennas have radials that come with it. If the radials are not a quarter wavelength long at the frequency of operation, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, then they do a pretty mediocre job of acting like a counterpoise. So even if you do have the radials, if you're using the hamstick on some other band that the radials are not tuned to, then the radials are almost not there. Then the mounting structure becomes the counterpoise, and you could easily run into the situation a little bit like what happens with the Ringo Ranger. The Ringo Ranger gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. In other words, it's not a very expensive antenna. It's got a nice impedance-matching ring at the bottom, but it doesn't really have counterpoise rods to it. Therefore, the mounting chunk of metal you connect it to becomes the counterpoise. There are people who mount it on one particular length of metal, and they think the antenna is the best thing since baked bread. And there are other guys who mount it on some other length of metal, and they say that the antenna is terrible. Well, you either do or don't have a resonant length of pipe that you mount it to. So, in that case of the Ringo Ranger. So, in your case, were you using the antenna on a frequency different than the design? Therefore, maybe the radials are not doing their job. Therefore, the length of the pipe is going to become very critical. And even if you mount it on PVC pipe, you still have a coax cable coming down. And the coax cable is another metallic structure, somewhat like the metal pipe. And depending on how much vertical coax cable you got before you bend it over horizontal could be a factor. Quite a bit going on here. So give me a couple more words as to center frequency, design, and how you're using it. K2TGW, K2RIW in the tech net.
And I guess I didn't explain myself completely. It originally was a 17-meter hamstick. It wasn't a hamstick, but same matter, same idea. And I found instead of using a radio, not a radio, an extension of, I don't know, 5 feet or more, if I made it just 6 inches, according to my MFJ-259B, it would resonate at 10 meters. At one point, I had it as a 10-meter rotatable dipole. At times it was 17 meters, at times it was 10 meters. So for the 10-meter contest in December, it became a 10-meter rotatable dipole. Well, I now have something else as a rotatable dipole, so I have this 17-meter hamstick left over, and as I said before, with 6 inches of extra extension, it comes out to a perfect 10-meter antenna. Now, when I originally have it, or the way it is back now, it has about 8 feet of wire as a counterpoise. But as soon as I raise it, now you mentioned that the coax was going down around it, but the coax would be well below it. It would not be even to it, especially when I was using the PVC tube, which is the reason why I did that against the steel mast, which I had it on originally. Then I could see how it could possibly change the frequency, but not on a PCB tube where the coax really doesn't go down more than a couple of inches. So I don't understand that part there.
Okay, I'm going to back you up about 5 sentences, Len, because something's bothering me. Les, sorry about that. A 10-meter half-wave dipole usually is in the vicinity of 16 feet long. A 17-meter dipole would be something in the vicinity of 27 feet long. You took this 17-meter antenna, or 10-meter antenna, added 6 inches to it, half a foot, and you told me it gave you a good visual on 17 meters. So you see what I'm confused here. A dipole that should be 16 feet long, roughly, on 10 meters, you add 6 inches to it, and it's acting like a dipole that should be 27 feet long. Wow. I'm wondering if you're getting some kind of a phony reading. I wonder if there's a real balancing device on the antenna, maybe your piece of coax cable is part of the radiation because there isn't a real balancing device. And I'm probably confusing something you told me. So run it by again. How did 6 inches of addition make a 10-meter antenna give you a good antenna in 17 meters? And by the way, when you find out how to do that list, I want to visit you, and you and I are going to file a patent. A K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Again, Dick, I guess I'm not communicating with you. It was a 17-meter hamster. Now, part of that, the base part, is a wire-wound antenna. And what you add on the other end makes a big difference. So you add just 6 inches against, I don't know, 5 feet or 6 feet where the other extension was, I think it does change the whole picture of what the frequency is. So I found if I use that, just that base part of the 17-meter handstick, instead of adding the 5 or 6 feet extension that they came with it, and just added 6 inches, it now radiated, or now I give you a great visual on 10 meters. So I counterpoise that with an equal part that should be for 10 meters. Hence, the SWR and the actual great way it works is on 10 meters. Now, if I wanted to work any other frequency, I have to change the end that you can tighten down or loosen up to change the total length of the whole antenna. Am I making more sense now to you?
You're going to get a little bit angry with me because I'm still a bit in the dark, Les. I'm going to ask some pretty silly sounding questions, so try to hang in there. These old guys are a little slow, meaning me. I'm 68 years old. Go easy with me. Alrighty. Ham stick, wire wound. Sure sounds like a vertically polarized antenna. Sounds like something would normally have some ground plane radials to it. Wire wound really means that it's a spirally wound, vertically polarized thing to give you some shrinkage. You told me it's roughly 5 feet long. I'm not sure now if it started off at 17 meters or 10 meters, but no matter which one it started off on, because it was wire wound, somewhat compacted, you were able to make it resonate on the other band by adding only 6 inches. Even that still sounds like kind of magic. In previous transmissions, you were telling me about a horizontally polarized dipole. That added confusion because I assumed the word hamstick would be a vertically polarized thing. I'm not sure what the ground plane radios look like on it. So go a little bit slow and try again. It's going to take at least four tries here, Les. And sorry about all that. K2TGW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
First of all, Dick, I'm older than you are. I have you by 2 years, so, it's one old person to the next, and I guess we're not communicating. All right, it is a hamstick. You can use it vertically or horizontally, depending on how you attach it to whatever fixture you're attaching it to. There's more than one. If you have two of these, and you put them on a insulated holder where each one is separated, so one is the center, one where it feeds off the center, one feeds off the outside, the coax, you can make it as a horizontal. At the present time, it is a vertical 10 meters. Now, as I said before, the total antenna as a 17 meter could be, I don't know, 12, 14 feet high. Not really sure. I don't have all the parts in front of me. But instead of having the 5 or 6 foot extra on the end, if you add just 6 feet on the end, 6 inches on the end, it is now an SWR of 10 meters. Am I making more sense?
Yep, coming closer. Vertically polarized. Before you made any modifications, you told me it is a 10-meter antenna. I don't know when you said those words, you mean after modification or before modification. So what did it start out as? Did it have ground plane radials? Was it roughly 5 feet long, wire wound? So I'm going to assume it started off at 10 meters. You added some length, and it went to 17. Is that roughly the picture? And I understand how you can make a dipole by putting a pair of them back-to-back. But maybe you didn't put them back-to-back yet because I haven't heard you use those words. Back to you, Les.
Yes, at one point they were back-to-back when I used it as a rotatable dipole. Now I'm just using it as a 10-meter vertical. And the base part, I presume, from what I gather from all the experimenting I have, would work on, since the base that it has, it would work for 17, 15, 12, and 10, depending on the length of the extra part that you connect to the top. You've got a hole in it with two set screws, and you can make use of the full length or whatever length you want, but as long as it's not less than 17 meters, because however they wire wound the bottom part, that's the minimum that you can work at. Understand?
Okay, 17 minimum. That sounds like the longest wavelength, and 10 sounds like the shortest. I'm a little confused with those words. So, the manufacturer does or doesn't give you rods to add to the top of it to make it work on the other bands. And the basic unit, is it a 10-meter antenna, and you add different rods to the top according to the manufacturer to make it go to 15 and then 17? Is that approximately what we're talking about here, Les? Go ahead.
Well, something like that. When I originally bought it, it was a 17-meter, or set up as a 17-meter hamstick. I bought two, and I bought the connecting parts so that I could insulate the two parts out and make a 17-meter rotatable dipole. That's history. No interest in that anymore, per se. So, but in my mind, I found if I change the length of the extension in the middle, especially one like this, which I just cut down, to a 6-inch piece, actually it's about 8 inches long, and the rest of it is inside the top of the handstick, so the clamp would work. That's what it's been. The minimum, or the maximum is the case, the way you want to go, would be 17 meters, and I guess I can't see it being less than 10 meters, because that's only a 6-inch extension. Anything less than that, it just doesn't function at all. At least I couldn't find that stuff you want.
Alrighty. The previous wording confused me that you had added 6 inches and now it worked on 10 meters. I'm slowly catching on. When you cut the rod that you add to the top down to 6 inches of length, it's on 10 meters. Roughly how long was that rod sticking out of the top to begin with? You said when you bought it, it was on 17 meters. Roughly how long was the rod then? Les, go ahead.
I think it was at least 5 feet tall. But I took another piece of rod. I wasn't going to cut that up in case I ever wanted 17 meters again. So I have other rods here, and I cut them down to, I guess it started about a foot, and then I figured out that I only needed 6 inches sticking out of the top.
Okay.
Okay, there's another ambiguity here. You told me before it was 5 feet of antenna. I assume the wire wound portion at the bottom was 5 feet. Boy, was I wrong on that. So you had a rod sticking out the top. It was 5 feet long. You bought the antenna. It was on 17 meters. When you lower that rod to only 6 inches of length, it's on 10 meters. Sounding good so far. The wire wound portion on the bottom, roughly how tall is that, Les? Go ahead.
That's between 4 and 5 feet.
Okay.
So therefore, 4 or 5 feet on the bottom, 5 feet of rod sticking out of the top, total of 10-foot long antenna, mechanically, on 17 meters. You lower the rod to 6 inches, so it's around 4.5 or 5 feet of antenna total with the rod, and you're now on 10 meters. I caught on to that. I haven't yet found out about, are the ground plane radials, and how long are they? And is it fed with or without balance when you go to the dipole version? So, clue me in on these sections here, Les. Go ahead.
When I had it as a horizontal dipole, no, I didn't use a balance. I don't know why I didn't. It functioned pretty well without it, so I didn't do it. With now, it only has 8 counterpoise, and that's on the proper dimension for 10 meters. So there's only 1 counterpoise now, and it's sitting on the side of the house.
When you first bought it, and it had 5 feet of rod sitting on the top, and it was a total of roughly 10 feet long, tuned to 17 meters, did it have counterpoise rods? Did it have 3 rods or so sticking out of the bottom? If so, before you go to dipole and you try to get it to 10 meters, what did you do with those rods if you ran it as a monopole on 10 meters? Go ahead.
No, it never had any radials at any time. At one time, I made a vertical dipole out of it, but then you've got to put it way up in the air, and I don't have any place to put that up right now. That, therefore, that, if you do it that way, it works best, you know, as far as being a vertical.
March 23, 2008. Station, please stand by. Okay, Les, by some means now, you took a pair of these, what do you call it now, hustler stick or something like that. You ran them as a dipole. You got crazy results at different altitudes off the ground. When first mounting them on a metal rod, and then mounting them on a piece of PVC pipe. Let's go back to the metal rod. When you had it on a metal rod, and you're running a pair of them back to back as a horizontally polarized dipole, was there any metal connection between either one of the hustler sticks and the metal support pipe? And you did tell us you didn't use a balance, therefore the coax cable is hot, therefore life is complicated. So give me a few more words on metal versus PVC altitude. Was it back-to-back dipole? And do I have that picture incorrect? Les, go ahead.
Yes, we're not talking about the same. I said at one time I had used it as a dipole. Now it is just a single monopole with a counterpoise. And it's in a base. And right now it's sitting on the side of the knee. But when I try to put it on anything else to get it higher, you know, there's only three things important when you have an antenna: height, more height, just a little more height. That's why I was having my problems. As soon as I brought it up to any further height, it seemed to detune itself. Hence the first question.
Okay, you may have been a little bit flippant with the words when you said now you're using a counterpoise. How did you do that? To me, the only counterpoise you can put on a vertical antenna on these kind of frequencies is either another half of a dipole and making a vertical dipole-like thing, or three rods sticking off to the side that are all quarter wavelength long. You said you mounted it to a counterpoise and then screwed it to the side of the house. How long is that counterpoise? What is it made out of? Back to you, Les.
Not sure the length of the wire, but it's just a piece of bell wire.
Okay, you're hanging a piece of wire vertically down from the grounded portion of the antenna. In other words, where the shield of the coax goes, and it's a length of wire you don't know the length of, but you're calling it a counterpoise. And without that being the proper length, and that can be kind of critical, that's part of the tuning of the antenna as I see it, Les. Let me give you a little bit of a crazy thumbnail suggestion here. I mean, an image. Assume now that you've probably heard me use this little example so many times before. It's going to bore people, but let me go through it one more time anyhow. Arnold Schwarzenegger, assuming weighs 200 pounds, he's floating in the cargo bay of the space shuttle while it's in orbit. He's weightless. In his hands are 200 pounds of barbell. He's motionless at the beginning of the experiment. He pushes the barbell to the north at 1 meter per second, 200-pound barbell. But he weighs 200 pounds. Therefore, by definition, action and reaction, Newton's third law, he moves in the opposite direction, 1 meter per second. So he pushes on the barbell. The two of them are separating 2 meters per second. Barbell goes 1 meter per second to the north. He goes 1 meter per second to the south. That's what happens when you push on something. The counterpoise of an antenna is something that the RF energy at the end of the coax cable pushes between. In the case of a dipole being fed in a thoroughly balanced manner, you're pushing positive voltage into the right-hand side, you're pushing negative voltage into the left-hand side at the first half of the cycle, and that's a balanced structure. It doesn't have to go anywhere. A dipole is nicely balanced, fed with a proper balance. In the case of a counterpoise antenna, your center conductor of the cable is trying to push positive voltage into the radiator section, but you've got to push current the negative voltage has got to be pushed into something else. It's the counterpoise. In the case of the Ringo Ranger, there ain't no counterpoise. It's the metal pipe you mount it to. So it pours negative current into the pipe when you're pouring positive current into the Ringo Ranger. And depending on the length of the pipe, it either works or it doesn't work. It gives you a good Vizwire or something terrible, both in Vizwire and pattern. So in order for you to push against the other half, the counterpoise, it's got to be electronically a quarter wavelength long, resonant. Otherwise, you're pushing into open space. You only get the right impedance on the counterpoise if it's the right length. I know that's kind of long. Maybe it helps a little bit. K2TGW, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Question?
Les first, go ahead.
Dick, I understand all that, and it's, that's all basic stuff. But my problem is using exactly what I had and moving at a different height, I got different... I mean, it detuned the antenna. You know, I was using an MFJ 259V at all times. I did not change the coax. I just changed the height of the basic antenna. And the higher I made it, the more it became detuned, whether I put it on a piece of PVC pipe or a piece of masting. I can understand the masting. I don't understand how a PVC pipe would detune the antenna. Hence the whole question in the first place. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think I see that. And now, in order for there to be a counterpoise, for this to be a resonant structure that doesn't depend on the length of the pipe it's mounted to, and doesn't depend on the length of the vertical portion of the coax, in order for that to happen, you've got a radiating section, which is this ham stick with a rod sticking out of the top. The other half of the antenna, the counterpoise, has to be electronically a quarter wavelength long. That piece of wire that you're calling counterpoise, that hangs in the bottom of it, must be electronically quarter wavelength long. And in order for the coax not to be part of the standing wave ratio in the antenna, a balun is required. What I think I'm hearing is that no balun was used, therefore the coax is hot. I'm not hearing evidence that the counterpoise piece of wire was electronically tuned to be a quarter wavelength long. So I see a possibility of two errors that made life a little more complicated here, Les. Now when you start combining altitude above the ground, a little bit of ground reflection, and a metal mounting structure before you use the PVC, which maybe it was trying to act like a counterpoise, but it wasn't the right length. It sounds like all of these situations that guys had with Ringo Ranger with various mounting structures. I know we got a bunch of people with questions on this. The first person who said question, who was that? Start off with your call letters and your name, sir.
K2MIT. When you were referring to adding the counterpoise, and horizontally, is that the same thing as capacitive hat? Would it electrically be the same?
Most likely no, Jeff. A real counterpoise is the other half of an antenna. Let me explain that in two or three different ways. If I was setting up a ground plane antenna in my back, a vertically polarized ground plane, the manufacturer, not to scare you, tells you to lay down two or three pieces of wire in the ground as a counterpoise and make them a quarter wavelength long on one or two of the bands. The real way to make the antenna work well is to lay down a whole lot of wires in the background. Like if you're a purist, you're going to lay down 32 wires in 32 different directions around the whole compass. And they're all going to be roughly a quarter wavelength long or longer. What you're literally doing is you're converting your backyard RF-wise into a skeleton structure that acts like a sheet of copper. That sheet of copper, skeleton structure-wise, is a mirror, and therefore you've got a real radiator, monopole, above the ground. You have the mirror image of one below the ground, very similar to a vertically polarized dipole. Now you're not heating up the earth with RF energy, making the worms warm in the wintertime, so to speak, and you can have an efficient antenna. Most antennas require a balance in order to not violate the Arnold Schwarzenegger example I gave. A real vertically polarized dipole or horizontally polarized dipole the left side and the right side are counterpoised to each other. You launch positive current from the right side, you take negative current away from the left side, everything is balanced with a good balancing structure. You violate that. You try to make only half of the dipole out there, and just because it's vertical, a lot of people fall into the trap of saying, gee, I don't have to build the other half. Well, the coax cable becomes the other half, the mounting structure becomes the half, and whatever. You need a balance. It's nice to think that, I'm going to ground it. Well, what does the word ground mean when you're mounting it 20 feet in the air? And even if you did mount it to ground, to be a good, efficient ground, takes a whole lot of wires out there acting like a sheet of metal. I wonder if some of that imagery helps a little bit, Jeff. KQMIT, KQLIW in the TechNet.
It does perfectly. I was thinking about my own antenna, and my question is later is much more fundamental. So thank you for answering that. I do appreciate it. K2MIT back to K2RIW and TechNet.
So as I see it, Les, you're going to be a step ahead if you make the counterpoise really a quarter wave long at your frequency of operation. And if you feed the thing with a balance, so that now the unbalanced current coming out of your coax cable has the ability to act like 70 ohm twin lead, assuming your vertical hamstick with its counterpoise acts like a vertically polarized 72 ohm dipole, and if you were feeding it with 72 ohm twin lead, everything would be hunky-dory. Your coax coming up there has RF energy on the center conductor, and the outer conductor is trying to act like a ground. And if you just connect center conductor to your hamstick and the shield to the counterpoise, and if the counterpoise is the right length, it's sort of get away with it. The wrong length, it does very little. Now all your countercurrent is flowing down the outside of the cable, the length of that cable, and how it is dressed, how much of it's vertical, how much of it's horizontal, how long it is, all of that makes the other half of the dipole, and it makes it hot, and it makes life complicated. So I think you can see a couple of suggestions I've got there as to how it's going to improve the situation. I do recommend a real balance. By the way, a poor man's balance would just be a few turns of the coax cable right at the feed point of the antenna. A couple of turns of the cable held together with black plastic tape is a kind of an RF choke. It's a poor man's balance that works very well, particularly on bands as high as 10 meters. So when you make some of these changes, Les, sure wish you'd help come back and tell us whether it worked better. I hope it does. If not, you can holler at me some more, and we'll eventually get it straight. K2TGW, K2RIW.
Well, the only problem is where it is now and how it is set up now, it is a perfect 10-meter antenna. You know, as long as you want to use vertical and it's not high enough. My problem is I always like to make things a little higher, a little longer, you know, whatever. But according to my MFJ 259B, at, 28.450, it is exactly a one-to-one SWR. It doesn't get out of it until some ridiculous number that I wouldn't be using it for in the first place. And it also occasionally gets used a little 10-meter FM, which is what you need in vertical, and it works perfectly on those. So, but I will try and measure out what the counterpoise should be or what I think it should be. And we'll get back to you on that, Dick. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, one last question. When you had it on a metal pipe up in the air at a higher altitude, was the counterpoise laying parallel to that metal pipe?
Yes.
Okay, even if it was the right length, that could detune it. So life's a little bit complicated. That counterpoise, though, in theory, is going to be almost as hot as the antenna, RF-wise. I know the antenna is a substantial-looking thing. Looks like it's set up for RF. And you and I would like to believe the RF is smart enough to go there and nowhere else. Well, it's got to push against something. It's got to push against that counterpoise. And hopefully the thing it pushes against is itself also a quarter wavelength long resonant to that open circuit at the bottom end and where you connect it at the top end. It acts like something that will accept some current, and therefore you got a real counterpoise. So I think it's an educational process. I know you're going to get there. Hang in there, Les. I know that Joe, with E2RYY, I think it was, had a couple of questions or suggestions. Go right ahead with those, Joe.
Not in particular to this, but the only comment I was going to say is, you know, the question you want about the whole, no more about the whole subject than I do, is the possibility of him tuning his actual the antenna and actually having the coax be part of a Balun type of fooling him at the end he's making the measurements at, where if he changed frequency, he probably knows very quickly that he didn't have quite the bandwidth that he thought he had on the thing. At one particular spot, maybe it was supposed to be a 2-3 quarter kilometer of bandwidth. It might be actually a lot less than that due to the Biswar effect of the cable.
Yeah, but when you're using a proper balancing device, the length of the cable does not change the Biswar. Lots of people believe that. Lots of people believe that there's a magic length of cable, quarter wavelength, half wavelength, odd number of quarter wavelengths, non-resonant length, whatever. They think the length of the cable will change the standing wave ratio. If it does, and there are times when it does, it means the outside of your coax cable's got RF energy on it. You're changing the length of that when you change the length of the cable. But if you've got low loss cable, and if it's a balanced structure at the far end, balancing structure at the far end, so that the RF energy is flowing down the center of the cable and not coming back down the outside, and if the cable's low in loss, and you add an extra length of cable, and if you've got a good Biswar meter, there should be no change in Biswar. If there is, your outside of your cable is hot, you've got more than one frequency present, there's a whole bunch of things. You've got a standing wave ratio meter that's not very well calibrated, it's not flat versus frequency. Lots and lots of people have seen the Biswar change versus length of cable, and they've come up with a zillion theories to explain why, and many of them have come to the conclusion that there are very magic lengths of cable which makes this all go away. If you believe that, there's a lot more to the story. There's a lot of errors involved. I wonder if that made some sense there, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, it does. I understand, I guess the basic thing. I thought if you have a half transmission line that's a half wavelength, it's going to have the same impedance at one end to the other end. And if you have a perfect load at the other end, you should see pretty well flat measurement. If you have a Biswar effect, a standing wave ratio effect, as you change your cable length, so does your Biswar. You don't agree with that?
Absolutely, positively, no. No, no. I don't know how I can put it any stronger. It doesn't. There's 1,000 guys on 20 meters right now saying that. It is not true. Standing wave ratio is a certain percentage of power coming back down the cable. That percentage of power coming back down the cable doesn't know how long the cable is. You make the cable a little bit longer, the exact same amount of power is coming back down the cable. I will admit that on your Smith chart, the impedance that you measure in the shack is going to walk around a circle on that Smith chart as you change the length of the cable. But the diameter of that circle on the Smith chart is the Biswar. The diameter doesn't change if it's low-loss cable. So once again, the impedance can go all over the place. Highly resistant, low resistance, high resistance. Capacitive or inductive, depending on length of cable. I'm walking around that circle on the Smith chart. But the percentage of reflected power on a properly balanced antenna doesn't go up and down because I changed the length of cable. Therefore, the percentage of power coming back is the same. Your bird wattmeter measures forward power, reverse power. You look at the forward power, the reverse power, the ratio. You go to a chart supplied by bird or in the antenna book or anywhere other place, amateur engineer's handbook, radio amateur's handbook, and it'll tell you what the Biswar is. You're suggesting the power coming back down the cable goes up and down versus length of cable. Assuming also that the outside of the cable is not hot. I say that does not take place. Now back to you, Joe.
Well, this wasn't my original question I was going to ask you anyway, but if you had an impedance that was, say, arbitrarily twice the impedance of the cable, okay? I don't know if it exactly gives you a 2-to-1 VSWR, If you say the antenna's impedance was 100 and your cable was 50, and at some point in your cable you measure that, you change the length of the cable, you're telling me that it does not change the effective visual you see from your whole entire circuit?
Absolutely not. If I put a 100 ohm pure resistor on the end of a 50 ohm cable, you're absolutely right, 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If the cable is some number of half wavelengths long and low in loss, I will measure 100 ohms in the shack. If I make the cable an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, like 1/4 wavelength long, the 100 ohms at the far end inside the shack will look like 25 ohms. 25 ohms on a 50 ohm cable is still a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. You're walking around the Smith chart. When you're on the right hand side of the Smith chart, you're going to see 100 ohms, that's the highest impedance. When you're on the left hand side of the Smith chart with that same diameter circle, you're going to see 25 ohms. When you're purely inductive up top on the Smith chart, you're going to see a mixture of R and C, which gives you a 2-to-1 visoir. The visoir does not change. The impedance changes. The magnitude of impedance, resistive component, and reactive component are changing in a kind of a crazy way. Only a Smith chart will show that to you in a way that makes a little bit more sense. But it does not change the visoir. It's still 2-to-1 everywhere along that cable, no matter where you chop it and open it up and put a connector on it. You've still got 2-to-1 on that cable, because the 2-to-1 visoir is a little bit more than 10% of the power coming back to you. 9.5 dB negative, S11 as they call it, reflective power ratio, is a 2-to-1 visoir. Let's call it a little bit less than 10% of the power, or is it a little bit more than 10%? A little bit more than 10% of the power is coming back to you on a 2-to-1 visoir. And no matter how long that cable is, if it's low and long, you'll still keep getting 10% of the power back when you got a 100 ohm resistor at the far end. I know this sounds crazy the first time you hear it. And when you hear it explained by the guys who are on their soapbox on 20 meters on every Saturday afternoon to a person who understands antennas and transmission lines a little bit better, they sit there and curl their nails and scrunch up their face and say, what in the world is going on here? The blind is leading the blind. You've heard lots of theories like that all your hold on life. I know that, Joe. I know you've been victimized by this because it is a very widespread old wives' tale, which has got 99% error and only a couple of percent truth to it. The K2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Let Joe say a couple of words because I just said some strong things to him, and then he's going to turn it over to you, Mel. You got it, Joe.
I understand that the circuit has the same reflective power coming back from the load at the end of the transmission line. I do understand that. I understand that being constant. But doesn't the effect voltage change along the cable? You have voltage nodes and current nodes?
Yes. The points where the voltage goes lowest and the current goes higher at that particular point, you have the so-called 25 ohm point along the cable. Then I move along a quarter wavelength further, the voltage is maximum and the current is minimum, and I now have the 100 ohm point. Yes, there are high and low current points, there are high and low voltage points, they alternate, and every one of those points is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Every one of those points is a little bit more than 10% reflective power. One of the magic things about coax that's very hard to believe is that the coax cable keeps the power that goes forward from the transmitter to the antenna completely separate from the power that flows back from the antenna toward the transmitter, even though it's the exact same frequency, even though the energy originally came from the same transmitter. It keeps the forward power and reverse power thoroughly separate. Coax cable does that magic. So does my guy wire. When I tap my guy wire and I watch a pulse go up the guy wire, hit the tower, which is a short circuit, it reverses in polarity and comes back toward me. If while this pulse is coming back, I tap the guy wire again and make another pulse go forward, those two pulses fold through each other. Even the guy wire keeps the forward-going energy and the reverse energy thoroughly separate. Opposite of common sense. It's magic the way transmission lines, that's a mechanical transmission line with my guy wire, or an electronic transmission line with your coax cable. It keeps them separate. Lots of people don't believe that. There's lots of experiments you can make that can lead you astray on this one. But the forward-going power and the reverse power are thoroughly separate. They don't mix. At any point in the cable, you can measure the reverse amount of power. It's always the same if the cable is low and long. Now, the guy who's able to take this complicated stuff and make it a lot more understandable is Mel. He's going to straighten us all out. K2KUI, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. How many times I've gone through this? Not on 20 meters. Stay away from that bunch. When they thought any of that was controversy. But on 75 meters, they've sort of got me trapped with my group that I get on a few nights a week. And this went on one night, the wee hours in the morning. And finally, I said, listen, tomorrow you just go to amateurradio.tv. I did this as an extensive coverage of this with the Smith chart. And again, the only way I can tell you the feed line is like a hose. In other words, you're pouring water in one end of the hose, water comes out the other end of the hose. That's more water. If I pour a gallon in one end, I'm just getting approximately the same thing out of the other end, or left whatever, you know, residual left over wetting the hose. But that's it. Now, if I pinch the hose somewhere along the line, the water may flow slower, but that 1 gallon of water that I put in there is going to get to that other end one way or the other. So the feed line has only got one thing it's supposed to do, is take the radio output and take it to the antenna input, and that's it. Now, I didn't want to touch upon whether what about tuners, because I had this whole thing the one night with trying to convince them that a tuner, that my box sitting there in your shack, tunes the antenna. And don't ask what I got with that, Dick. Won't even go near it, I don't think, anymore. I'm going to play dumb next time. Over.
Oh, what a tuner does. A significant number of amateurs think that the tuner makes your terrible antenna, your 2-to-1 antenna, makes it look like 1-to-1 to the transmitter. They accept that. Of all the reflective power that hits the tuner on the output end, coming back from the antenna, they assume the tuner just throws it away somehow, magically, and that the tuner corrects the visual, but it wastes power. However, when you start asking them questions, gee, I'm putting a kilowatt into this tuner, and there's only three things that can happen to the power I'm putting into it. It's passing it on to the antenna, it's radiating it into space, or it's turning it into heat. If your tuner is well shielded, it's not radiating into space. If it's running ice cold to the touch, it ain't turning it into heat. The only thing it can be doing is passing the power up to the antenna in a way the antenna wants to see it. Every one of the antennas we all use, with the exception of a rhombic or a beverage, these are antennas that are a zillion wavelengths long with a terminating resistor at the far end. That's a so-called traveling wave antenna. The signal goes down that antenna once and dies during transmission. With the exception of that antenna, every other antenna we touch is a standing wave structure. The signal bounces back and forth within the antenna a number of times before it gets radiated. We must resonate that energy. It's going to bounce a whole lot of times, and we got to keep all of those bounces in step, otherwise the current gets wasted, it doesn't get radiated. So that is resonance. When you resonate an antenna, you are resonating the radiating structure. Okay, what is the radiating structure? The thing called antenna, the thing called feed line, the thing called tuner if you've got it, and the final tank circuit of the transmitter. That radiating structure, tank circuit, tuner, feed line, and antenna, that total structure, you will resonate it with every one of the 98% antennas we use, standing wave structures. You will resonate that whole assembly or you will not radiate well. That's it. That's the bottom line. You will resonate that total structure. If your antenna tuner has got enough range, you can take the yuckiest antenna in the world, a very random length of wire wrapped around a tree and all kinds of things. You can make it a good load to your system. You can pour power into it. Now, whether you're not going to waste it and heating up the tree, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to worry about that. But that structure of the radiating system, I shouldn't be calling it a radiating system. That total system must hit resonance to radiate well. The first time you hear this, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense. I know it's not an easy concept to accept. And you talk to the people.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Lots of people have got lots of nasty opinions about antenna tuners, and they'd rather not use them. Now, I know I've opened up a little bit of a can of worms here, Joe, but you're going to have to hear this two or three more times before it sinks in, if you're the average guy. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, one more thing, Dick, K-2-R-Y-Y.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, one of the proofs I said to them, raise your SWR up if you can, going off, way off frequency with the antenna. Look at your SWR going up. Take a look at your power, your forward power. How come you can wind up with more power going out than the rig is rated at? And when, as the SWR goes up, I said, how come your power output is also going up? Where's that coming from? And that's all I get over.
Yeah, to a guy who's got a good scientific mind, Mel, that's a pretty good proof that energy is bouncing back and forth in the system. And by the way, what that antenna tuner does, it acts like a tank circuit that has greater tuning range. Back in the old days when we had great big transmitters, like a Heathkit HW100 or a DX100, the Heathkit DX100 had a great big tank circuit with 365 picofarad variable capacitors for C1, maybe something just as big for C2, a capped inductor. That could match even a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio of almost any phase angle. Well, we all started desiring very compact transistorized transmitters with tiny little tank circuits, and pretty soon the manufacturer said, okay, I can give you that, but you can't go beyond 1.7 on standing wave ratio, otherwise the rig will go into a self-protect mode. It doesn't have that much tuning range. Then they sell you back the tuner that used to be there, the tank circuit, in a separate box. It's called tuner. And now you've got the large tuning range of your tank circuit back again. But what that large tuning range tank circuit does is it resonates the radiating system. Tank circuit, feed line, and antenna. You radiate it, and the energy can be bouncing back and forth instead of 10 times, 20 times, because you've got a higher VIS-WR antenna. It still gets radiated with 90-some-odd% efficiency. What happens with the energy that reflects from your antenna, if your antenna did not accept all the energy from the feed line, because the antenna was not a 50-ohm resistor at your favorite frequency, if it reflects some of that energy, the energy that comes back to the tuner when you properly set it gets re-reflected forward in phase with the energy coming out of the transmitter right now. Voltage-wise, it adds. You would think it adds in a power manner. It adds in a voltage manner. That's the way resonators work. Therefore, your bird wattmeter that's in the middle of that transmission line after the tuner and to the antenna can read 150 watts forward, even though your transmitter is only generating 100 watts. Is there really 150 watts forward on that transmission line? Yea, verily. I can put a directional coupler on there. I can sample that power. I can light a light bulb with it. There's a hell of a lot of guys out there who tell you, let me drop, that is reactive power, if not real. Ha! That energy bouncing back and forth in your transmission line, because you've got standing wave ratio and you've got an antenna tuner properly tuned. That energy that's bouncing back and forth, is it reactive power? You can call it that if you like. You can call it a virus if you like. As far as I'm concerned, it's real. I can take a sample of it with a good directional coupler, and I can light a light bulb with it. I can heat a resistor with it. To me, it is real power. It is power bouncing back and forth, because it is greater power than you generated, and that used to upset people. They gave it this funny name, reactive power. It's real. That transmission line is keeping the forward going power and the reverse power completely separate. It's letting them bounce it if you want it to. It's because you have to put a good load at the far end, and you've corrected it with an antenna tuner in the shack. That antenna tuner in the shack, as long as your feed line is low enough and long, will correct for errors in the antenna itself. From a remote distance, 50 feet away, you are tuning your antenna system. For all practical purposes, you're tuning the antenna. You say those words on 80 meters tomorrow morning, to get a bunch of people jumping down your throat saying you're crazy.